dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. For many years, a very important battle space in that war, of course, has been the Middle East. We've seen the United States engaged in military operations there, and in the absence of our engagement in such conflicts, we've had a sort of hardy perennial of, well, post-World War II up to the present moment, a running effort on the part of a state that was created in 1949, the Jewish State of Israel, to seek its destruction on the part of assorted of its neighbors. A particularly aggressive element in that mix has for decades now been a population that call themselves Palestinians. And they are now in the throes of making very aggressive noises about what might happen if Israel were, pursuant to promises that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made repeatedly, including most recently in the last election, to annex or declare sovereign control over parts of the area that has historically been known as Judea and Samaria, is popularly called the West Bank. To discuss all of this with us, I'm thrilled to say we have with us for two segments a dear friend and very, very admired colleague, and one of the most thoughtful men I know on matters involving Middle East peace, the demographics of the region, the fundamentals of the strategic character of the challenges that Israel is facing today. He formerly served as a very senior diplomat in Israel's foreign service, rising to the rank, as I recall, of ambassador with responsibility specifically for representing Israel's interests with the Congress of the United States here in Washington, D.C. His name is Ambassador Yoram Edinger, and we're thrilled to have him with us. And Mr. Ambassador, this is a very important moment for us to catch up with you, so thank you for finding some time for us to do so. The reason the timing is important, I think it's fair to say, is that this issue of how Israel will proceed with this initiative of Benjamin Netanyahu's is precipitating not only some serious pushback from the Palestinians, which is to be expected, but also from Jordan, which is widely regarded as a nation that is both allied with the West and important to maintaining what passes for peace between Israel and some of her neighbors. I wanted to start this conversation with you by talking a bit about a very powerful essay that your ambassador in Washington at the moment, Ron Dermer, a man who's a longtime friend of both of ours, had written in the Washington Post about a week or so ago, in which he talks about the illusion of a two-state solution. And I wonder if you might just sort of bring us up to speed on what's going on at the moment by reference to that characterization of the problem.
Well, it seems to me that in order to realize the potential of a Palestinian state, whether you call it a two-state solution, whether you call it a Palestinian state, is to examine its potential impact upon America's own interest. You mentioned Jordan before, which is a relatively pro-U.S. Arab country. And just a reminder that back in October of 1994, when the Israel-Jordan peace treaty was concluded, Jordanian military commanders approached their Israeli colleagues, asking them to make sure that Israel will not allow the establishment of a Palestinian state, because according to the Jordanian military commanders, a Palestinian state west of the river would doom the pro-U.S. Hashemite regime in Jordan east of the river. We have seen similar attitudes also on the part of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, all of whom embrace the Palestinian with very, very warm rhetoric, but the Arab talk towards the Palestinians has been very cold and many times very negative for one cardinal reasons. The track record of Palestinians in various Arab countries has been replete with subversion and terrorism and joining radical regimes in the Middle East. And therefore, I must say that I am pretty disappointed that the Trump plan would include the potential establishment of a Palestinian state, because a state which would doom the pro-U.S. Hashemite regime with potential negative ripple effects into Saudi Arabia and the Arabian Peninsula, and potential embrace by the Ayatollahs of Iran and Russia and China and North Korea, should not be welcomed by the U.S. In fact, should be shelved as deeply as possible in the drawer rather than be brought into the limelight.
Ambassador Edgard, we're going to come back to the Trump plan, the deal of the century, as the president has called it, after a short break. But before we get to that, just a quick update for us. You closely follow, as I mentioned earlier, the demographics of the Middle East, and particularly those of the Palestinians, how numerous they are and where they are and so on, and how that relates to this question of the, as some would have it, the inevitability of a requirement for a Palestinian state because they're simply outbreeding, I guess one might say, the Israelis, and therefore will take over the Jewish state as a matter of electoral politics in due course. At least that's been the theory. But talk for a moment, if you would, sir, about the demographics of Jordan. What was said back in 1994, which you hopefully call to mind, was obviously a somewhat different time. The size of the Palestinian population in Jordan now, as I understand it, is a substantial majority, and it really perhaps dooms the kingdom of the Hashemites more than anybody else, don't you think?
Well, there is a very substantial Palestinian majority in Jordan when you compare Palestinians on one hand to Bedouins on the other hand. The Hashemite family or the Hashemite regime, they are Bedouins. However, having a minority regime is very typical in the Middle East. We haven't had in the Middle East since the 7th century, in fact, we haven't had a single democratic regime in the Middle East.
Except, of course, the State of Israel. And, sir, we have to just pause. Hold that thought. When we come back, I want to talk with you about sort of what this means for stability and the present question of what to do about these key areas of the West Bank. We'll be right back with more with Ambassador Yoram Edinger, a distinguished Israeli diplomat, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting for these first two segments of the show today on a very, very important issue, I believe, for all of us who love freedom, and that is the issue of the security of the State of Israel, a close and very strategically important ally of our country. We're talking with one of its most, I believe, accomplished and impressive diplomats, now retired. His name is Ambassador Yoram Edinger. And we're focusing in on this question of how to adjust the status of key and strategic areas of Judea and Samaria so as to ensure the longtime security of the State of Israel. And Mr. Ambassador, you were talking a little bit about the sort of future viability, really, I guess, of the Jordanian Hashemite kingdom in the face of what is a very substantial, and I think it's fair to say, increasingly hostile Palestinian population?
Well, as I mentioned, in Jordan, we have a minority regime of Bedouins over majority of Palestinians, which is very typical to the Middle East other than Israel, where we don't have a single democracy. In fact, we have in the Middle East a term which we call one bullet regimes. You rise to prominence through one bullet to the head of the former ruler, and you're going to be terminated by a bullet into your own head. We don't have too many, very, very few peaceful transition of power in the Middle East. And that only underlines the importance to Israel of the control of the mountain ridges of Judea Samaria, or the mountain ridges of the West Bank. The precaution in Middle East has to take into consideration a swift, unpredictable change of power. And since rulers are very tenuous, therefore policies are very tenuous in the Middle East. And as a result, agreements and treaties are very tenuous. So peace signed one day is liable to be abruptly violated the following day. And the question is your national security based on a sunny day or a rainy day scenario? And obviously, in the Middle East, there are many, many more rainy days than sunny days.
At least geostrategically, not so much in terms of the actual climate.
Yeah, climate-wise, it's the reverse. But at the same time, the Israeli control of the mountain ridges of Judea Samaria constitutes a very viable national security interest for the U.S. Israel on the mountain ridges of Judea Samaria, Israel on the mountains of the Golan Heights in the north, constrains the Ayatollahs, constrains ISIS, bolsters the national, the homeland security of Jordan in face of radical powers. That is the reason why in recent years Israel ties with every single pro-American Arab country, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, the United Arab Emirates, the ties between Israel and those countries have expanded unprecedentedly, while there is no movement, there is complete paralysis on the Palestinian front for a simple reason. As far as Arabs are concerned, Israel is regarded as the most credible life insurance agent in the region. We are a credible life insurance agent for pro-American Arab regimes because we have reflected very sound postural deterrence. Much to that postural deterrence is Israel's control of the high grounds in our region, the mountains of Judea Samaria and the Golan Heights. Should we retreat from those mountains, we are going to erode severely that posture of deterrence, which would deny the U.S. a major, major outpost which stretches the strategic arm of the U.S. without the need to deploy a single American soldier. Should we retreat from those mountains, the pro-American Arab regimes would lose a major, major line of defense, which would please very much the Ayatollahs in Tehran, ISIS, potentially also Erdogan's of Turkey. And therefore, going back to the issue of a Palestinian state on the mountain ridges would mean for the U.S. a loss of a major force multiplier, which today is represented by Israel.
This is such a vitally important strategic analysis, and you've touched on many of the key points. Sir, we clearly need to understand the importance of topography. Our mutual friend Mark Langfan, of course, done much to help elevate this as an area of interest and concern. We're also looking at relationships between Israel and other states in the region, all of whom are threatened by the Iranians, notably, and I think increasingly by the Turks as well. When you look at the prospects here, I want to ask sort of a twofold question. For making a permanent arrangement that is resilient in the face of the sorts of changes that you say can happen with a bullet at any moment, what should Israel be doing with respect to formalizing its control of those high ground areas that it has, basically, since the 1967 war, first? And second, how is the U.S. government's so-called peace plan under the Trump administration impeding or actually authorizing such steps?
Well, certainly hesitancy on the part of Israel feeds more radical attitudes by our neighbor. And hesitancy, I refer to our presence on the mountain ridges of Judea Samaria in the Jordan Valley along the border with the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. On the other hand, if we assert ourselves by applying the Israeli law to these areas, we'll send a very decisive signal that we have no intention of retreating, of appeasing, of compromising over our national security. While this would generate a very negative verbal reaction on the part of every single Arab country, but when it comes to the actual walk, not just talk, this would send a very comforting signal to them that Israel indeed is going to be a long-term reliable life insurance agent for them. As far as the Trump plan, here we have to be realistic in my mind. Namely, the Trump plan is the first plan by any American administration which recognizes Israel's Jewish roots in Judea and Samaria. But at the same time, it also includes the principle of a proposed Palestinian state pending compliance with very, very strict preconditions, which one may call strict peaceful preconditions. The problem when it comes to reality is that the president will not be in the White House following January 2025. Who knows, maybe not even following January 2021. Once again, we have to be ready for rainy day scenario, not only sunny days scenario. And when it comes to preconditions for the Palestinians to get a state, we have to assume that there may be a different school of thought, different than the Trump school of thought, deciding whether Palestinians do or do not comply with those preconditions. I think it would be fair to assume that Biden would be much more lenient on interpreting the preconditions than is the Trump team. I hear from the Trump team that Palestinians will have to become Canadians in order to qualify for a state. Well, I also assume that should there be another team in the White House, they may conclude that Palestinians can remain Palestinians and still qualify for a state. At that stage, once again, there may be a Palestinian state on these mountains, which would doom the Hashemite regime in Jordan. That would send very negative ripple effect south of Jordan into Saudi Arabia and the Arabian Peninsula, dealing a major blow to American interest in the Middle East. And therefore, as far as I'm concerned, I would feel much more secure and comfortable, by the way, for America's own interest, if the Trump plan would not have any reference to a potential Palestinian state. Palestinian state on one hand and Middle East stability on the other hand constitutes a classic oxymoron.
Now, this is, I think, sort of the thrust of Ron Dermer's op-ed as well, is that we need to get past the illusion and be much more practical about all of this. Let me just say, Mr. Ambassador, in closing, what you've just described as the imperative of getting on with it reminds me very much of the conversations that were taking place in Washington, among other places, including, I think, Jerusalem, about the idea of moving the U.S. embassy to Israel's capital, namely the city of Jerusalem. And there was all kinds of talk, well, we can't do that, or it's going to precipitate all kinds of rioting in the streets or upheaval in the Middle East. Let's just continue to temporize or discuss or fulminate about it. And to Donald Trump's great credit, he just cut through it and said, no, we're going to do it. And as you say, Mr. Ambassador, there was some carping, but things settled down fairly quickly thereafter and properly. So we have to leave it at that. Ambassador Yoram Edinger, thank you so much for your time today, as well as both your corporate memory and your just plain common sense in terms of what America's interests are, which I believe are very much as you do with a secure Israel in a dangerous Middle East. Come back to us again, sir, with updates, if you would. We'll talk more about all of this in the moments to come with Dr. Harold Rode, another of our duty experts on the region, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a delight to say, joined by one of our country's real duty experts on the Middle East, most especially a couple of its, well, most malignant countries, I think it's fair to say, Iran and Turkey. And we're going to talk with him in due course about that. His name is Dr. Harold Rode. He is these days a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute. But for many years, including back when I was in the U.S. Defense Department, he has been the go-to guy for successive secretaries of defense and other senior officials for insights into what really is going on in the Middle East. What are the vital interests of the United States and how are they being impacted by developments there? A fantastic resource, the author, among other things, of Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine, Marches On, published, I'm proud to say, by the Center for Security Policy Press. Dr. Rode, it's good to have you back. Welcome. Well, we were just talking with a mutual friend of ours, Ambassador Yoram Edinger, and I thought I'd just sort of double back with you and touch on a couple of the things that he said that I thought were quite important and get an American's perspective on this as well. You spend a lot of time in Israel, of course, but you are looking at it, I think, first and foremost, from the perspective of an American national security policy practitioner of great accomplishment. So talk a little bit about what is the strategic importance for our own country, not just for the state of Israel, of ensuring that from this point forward, as has been the case for the past, whatever it's been, 60 years, Israel is in charge of in controlling the vital high ground of the so-called West Bank, Judea and Samaria. And aren't we well advised to get on with it if that is the case?
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with you, Frank. But let me, if you don't mind, say for American interests, let's talk a little bit about the others in the Middle East. We're constantly hearing that the head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, is threatening, I'm going to commit suicide if Israel does this. And we're hearing in public all sorts of things from the Jordanians. The Egyptians are pretty quiet. Some of the Gulfies are saying one thing, but I want to quote Yasser Arafat, the guy who was head of the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization terrorist, and how he understood this, because I really think it gives in, it tells us what all the words that people are using and what is really going on. Arafat said, there is the truth And then there's its brother. In other words, whatever I say in public and private are very different things. And in public, the leaders feel or that they, in order to quiet things down, they have to say one thing. But behind the scenes, they're not only, it seems, for America's allies in the Gulf and the Jordanians, they are not only resigned to it, I think that they really like the idea.
And when you say it, in this case, you mean the formal, is it annexation? I've heard that term used, or is it extension of sovereign control on a permanent basis? What is the it here?
It is the extension of sovereignty. Annexation means taking someone else's territory. And the only international legal binding agreement or law, if you wish, on who owns this territory is the San Remo Agreement in, I think it was 1920, where the nations of the world at the time basically gave this territory today, what is Britain, what is Israel, let's say the West Bank and Jordan, to the British. And it makes very clear, if you read what the San Remo Agreement says, is that it is to, the British are to make sure that it is the national homeland for the Jewish people. And the British were supposed to encourage it by that. Now, that's the only thing which defines what the who the territory belongs to.
And that clearly covered, just Harold, again, for geographic situation here, that clearly covered at a minimum all of the real estate between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, which would be both the so-called West Bank and the main body of the Jewish state itself at the moment.
Yes, yes. And the bottom line then is that all Israel is doing, and Israel is the national homeland of the Jewish people, and all that what Israel has done, there's no change. It hasn't taken someone else's territory. It was never anybody else's. Jordan annexed it in 1951, and it is illegal by the San Remo document. But it, by San Remo, belongs to the Jews. The Bible is another story. It's very clear in the Bible who it belongs to. God gave it to the Jewish people.
This area of Judea and Samaria, as well as the lowlands of Israel. Okay, so Harold, you've set this up nicely. This is not a question of annexation. This is a question of extending sovereign control on a permanent basis. And you're saying that even though the Hashemite king of Jordan is claiming that this is, you know, going to be the end of peace with Israel and all manner of other, you know, strategically dangerous developments will flow from it, secretly, he wants it to happen, as do his friends and allies in the region, who happen, as Yoram Edinger was telling us, to have pretty much made separate pieces with Israel, whether it's publicly acknowledged or not, because they're aligned, at least for the moment, against common enemies like Iran and arguably Turkey as well. Is that right?
Yes. Well, let's just take the Jordanians. Jordan itself today is filled with, people say, between 60, 70 to 90% West Bankers originally. People came from the West Bank of the Jordan and settled in Jordan. Yeah. Okay, now, Palestinians. Now, the last thing that Jordan wants is a border in its western border, that is the Jordan border. They don't want a Palestinian state because they want the Israeli troops on that border because on the river, because it protects Jordan from troublemakers coming, Muslims from the West Bank into the East Bank, Jordan proper, and to foment danger to potentially overthrow the Jordanian monarchy. With Israel on the Jordan River, that is not going to happen. So Jordan desperately wants the Israelis on the on the banks of the western bank of the Jordan River.
So you have made a lifetime of study of the difference between what these governments and people like them say publicly and what they do. Jorn Mettinger made the same point. Americans tend to take at face value what people say. I mean, we're trusting, I guess, to a fault, perhaps. But Harold, how important is it to really understand the motivations here and true policy, you know, preferences?
Well, Frank, on a point that you just made, which I think is critical, you and I spent many years in the Defense Department, and if you would have if you'd read the cables of that ambassadors would send with their meetings from various foreign leaders, you would hear directly what the words that the foreign leaders said. There's only one problem: the meaning of this. When someone in the Middle East, for example, looks at you in the face, they can lie. They're protecting themselves. They're not trying to be mean or do something wrong, but they are lying to protect themselves. And unlike us here in the United States, we look at somebody, if we look at someone in the face and then look away, it's one of the signs that people may be lying or not telling you the truth. In the Middle East, they'll look you directly in the face. They'll say whatever. And they're lying through their teeth. And our people, American officials, have difficulty with this.
Yeah, absolutely. We have, in addition to just sort of the cultural practice, you have a religious justification for it too, do you not? When you're dealing with infidels, if it advances the faith or what's perceived to be the faith's interests, lying is not just permissible, it's obligatory, is it not, under Islam?
In Islam, anything which advances Islam is permittable or permissible. I guess let's think this through. What it means is you can tell anybody anything as long as it advances Islam. And so you could, what we would call lying, they may call it, let's say, dissimulation. The word is taqiyya in Arabic. And it means I will tell you, Frank, anything that I want which will advance my goals. And I'll look you straight in the face, and Americans will say, oh, well, he obviously meant it. He looked me straight in the face. He smiled. He shook my hand.
We saw eye to eye, and all this has been influential in American policy, in which, of course, as you know better than just about anybody, Harold Rowe, there's been a tendency to want to please these interlocutors, to advance their agenda, to accommodate their demands, and so on. So this gets us to the nub of the problem here. It is in Israel's strategic interest. It is in Jordan's strategic interest. It is in the interests of such other so-called friends as we have in the Middle East. And as Yoram Edinger, I think, persuasively argued, and you have too, Harold, it is in America's interest that Israel be on that border and secure and helping to keep the Hashemite kingdom, among others, secure, irrespective of what they say, and getting on with it is very much to be preferred over dithering, which can only cause us more grief. Harold, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, we can finish your thought, and then we will move on to two really, really important problems as opposed to the Palestinian fandango, Turkey and Iran. That and more with Harold Rowe, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're going to start, I think, actually, Harold, with a little bit of a conversation about some of the other players in the Middle East, the not so friendly ones. One is nominally not just a friend, but an ally of the United States. You, perhaps more than just about anybody I've ever met, have a deep appreciation for Turkey, for its culture, for its history, for its, well, its current government for sure, but also its antecedents. And I want you to just catch us up, Harold, on what Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the now, it appears, dictator for life of Turkey, is up to, both vis-a-vis some of the things we were just talking about, the state of Israel, the capital city of Israel, Jerusalem, and more broadly in the region, including with respect to its neighbor Iran.
Well, it's an interesting segue, because Erdogan wants to reestablish in some form the Ottoman Empire. He is active everywhere. He's active in the Balkans. He's active in Western Europe. He's interested in expanding Islam. What he's doing in Jerusalem is really dangerous. He is, for all intents and purposes, a leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is an organization which wants to simply, first of all, take over the Muslim world as it had in the past, because Turkey ran the Sunni world, not Iran, and then expand this all throughout Europe, which is why he is letting the refugees in Turkey cross into Greece and then to the rest of Europe, because he wants to take it over. You're going to get more Muslims. The Muslims have more children. The Europeans are unfortunately post-Christian, and so they don't believe in anything. They're not having babies. The Muslims are. So that's what his general goal is. Now, on the Jerusalem issue, why this is important is that the Jordanians have asked the Saudis to join them on the committee that's called the Waqf Committee, the committee which is responsible for the mosques on the Temple Mount. Why would the Jordanians want the Saudis? It's an interesting thing. It's because the Turks are, that is Erdogan and his people, are trying to take over the Muslims of Jerusalem. They're trying, everywhere you go, again, it's written in Arabic and sometimes in Turkish, there are signs and pictures of Erdogan in the Muslim areas. Now, the pictures, it's understandable. You look at Erdogan and you put a picture, frankly, of him at his age and Hitler beside him. They look very similar, coincidentally. But what I'm saying is, if you read the Arabic signs, you see all these what appear to be benevolent societies of helping Muslims in Jerusalem all over the place. And this is simply the attempt that Erdogan is doing everywhere to try to take this over. Well, the Jordanians are petrified.
So these benevolent societies are using a favored technique of some of the groups that Erdogan has supported over the years, Hamas, even Hezbollah, I think, who are working through aid to various populations to try to curry favor to establish schools or hospitals or what have you, and thereby enlist the population. And Harold, I just want to come back to something you said a moment ago. Erdogan is effectively the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood was founded back in the 1920s to reestablish the caliphate. This is part and parcel of reestablishing the Ottoman Empire, is it not, with the Erdogan, you know, sort of caliphate, if you will, at its core. With all of that, Harold, what is Israel doing? I mean, Saudi Arabia obviously doesn't like this. Evidently, the Jordanians don't like this because they both have decided the MB is a problem, though I guess it's still inside the government of Jordan, is it not? But what about the state of Israel? What is it doing about the obvious hostile character of Erdogan and the build-out of infrastructure inside its capital city?
Well, I would argue that from an Israeli point of view, if you look at Israeli policy in Syria, you can learn something in what they should be doing also vis-a-vis the Muslims in the West Bank. Now, in Syria, Israel very smartly decided that it would not take sides in all of the fights that are the fighting between various groups in Syria. If they would do anything, then they would be accused by one side. The other side of the problem would be accused of being pro-Israeli or Zionist tools or whatever. Now, on Jerusalem, the fact that if you add the Saudis to the mix, who have the money and the Jordanians are impoverished versus the Turks, and the Turks are getting their money from the Qataris, what you have here is let them fight out their battles. Now, the Saudis, for Their intellectual godfather was a guy by the name of Ibn Taymiyyah. He lived in, doesn't matter, late 1200s, early 1300s. He hated Jerusalem. He said there were only two holy cities in Islam, Mecca and Medina, and he accused the Jews. He hated the Jews. And he said the only reason that anybody believes that Jerusalem is holy in Islam is that the Jews who converted to Islam supposedly tried to make it He called it the Judaification, the Judaizing of Islam. He hated Jerusalem. He hated Hebron, where Abraham is buried as well. And he hated the Jews. And the Saudis, that is their intellectual godfather. They don't care about Jerusalem. But it's become a political issue. And Israel should do the following. Let them work it out. They want to kill each other. They want to do whatever. That's fine. But when there are disputes between them, the Turks and the Saudis, Israel should be the arbiter between them. What does that mean? You have a problem? Israel should make the decisions of what is going to happen on the Temple Mount. That in the Middle East, is when you're the boss, you matter. And let the Turks and the Saudis work it out. The hatred they have between each other is unbelievable. Both supposed allies of the United States, I say supposed because in the long run, if you look culturally, who and what they are, their goals are inimical to those of the United States. So I want to tell you what is interesting is I've watched this for years, and I was in Macedonia, which is in Southeast Europe, and what I saw vis-a-vis what Erdogan was doing with the Muslims was exactly the same thing that it's doing in Jerusalem and in other places. His pictures are everywhere, and people look at him as God. He's number one. He is our leader. This is what people were saying to me.
This makes me very nervous, I have to say, Harold, about just letting them work it out, because I have the feeling the Saudis aren't going to be up to this game if what really matters is having boots on the ground, as they say. And it seems to me Erdogan has demonstrated a capacity to do that. We're now seeing his boots on the ground literally in places like Libya. But let's turn quickly to Iran, Harold. We only have a couple of minutes, but just your current reading on what Iran is up to and the willingness of these two power blocks, if you will, Iran and Turkey, divided by their respective, sects within Islam, Sunni in the case of Turkey, Shia in the case of Iran. Are they making common cause now to the detriment of our interests and allies in the region?
At times, yes. At times, no. They're at loggerheads in Syria. They, on the other hand, remember, the common goal is to get America out, to humiliate America. And in that, they have a common goal. Iran, both of them are financially in very bad shape, but Iran is in catastrophic state. And what America is, again, very rightfully doing is trying to squeeze Iran that, God willing, without an invasion or anything like that, we don't need to do that. But if things get so bad, we are trying, basically, encouraging the Iranian people to take matters into their own hands. At the moment, that doesn't seem like it's going to happen because the regime is doing everything it can to stay in power, and the amount of murders, rapes, and rape means, we naturally think in the West, it means men raping females, female prisoners. But rape in the Middle East also means men raping men. You can understand what that means. And that's what the Iranians are doing all over the place. They are wreaking havoc on their own people. And let's just hope that sooner or later something will, that there'll be a spark.
Well, as long as we're hoping, let's hope it's sooner, because it's awfully late as it is 40 years on. Harold Rode, we have to leave it at that. We appreciate so much your insights. I think you and Ambassador Ettinger have made a terrific bookend on this topic, bringing to bear both the interest and perspectives of the region as well as those of our own country. And we appreciate you so much. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. And I know you'll keep up the good work at the Gatestone Institute in the meantime. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.